Number 8941, rule number 3.
Major Jefferson, reel 3.
Well, I don't know that I can remember anything about sun compass, except that I do remember driving with this little thing that looked like a sundial, except that the centre pin went straight up, and making little adjustments for deviation and that sort of thing, which in those days were automatic and fairly easy to do, but today...
Presumably it must have depended on the time of day and where the shadow was falling.
Yes, just as I used to be able to tell the time by the position of the sun. And tell the direction by the angle of the sun on my watch. I forget the details. But I mean, in those days, they were instinctive. But even today, this question of second nature, if I see a tree, I'd like to call it the bushy top tree. If I see a copse with a very sharp edge, I'm likely to say that's a good aiming point. One tends... Oh, bless you, darling. One's fingers... one's observation of ground... you would look at a coombe and say, what a splendid gun position. And you'd look at a hill and imagine the dead ground behind it. Not always with success, but it was instinctive in those days, because don't forget, I was primarily engaged in gunnery from 1938 almost until 1946, and quite a lot of that time I was actually up forward using my instincts.
Do you think that this eye for ground is something that you are born with, or is it something that you had learned and you had improved by constant practice?
I think that there are undoubtedly some people who are born with it, just as there are some people who play stringed instruments. But at the same time, I think that I don't think I was born with it. I think that it was something that I learned as a question of survival, as much as anything else, and interest.
To return to the journey across to Egypt, how many miles a day were you covering?
Well, it would be something between 100 and 200, wouldn't it? We did the 1,500 miles in 15 days, effectively. That included one or two overnight stops, one or two overday stops. So we would be moving, I would think, on average about 150 miles a day. I think the longest one would probably be 240 and the shortest one under 100.
And how many hours a day were you actually moving?
Well, I was advance party all that way, and therefore I probably was only actually moving for 4 or 5 hours. But the guns, of course, weren't getting in until fairly late sometimes. And the Remy wagon at the end was probably only just making it.
Did you have a lot of breakdowns on the way?
Yes. I would like to check the accuracy of this, but certainly we had a lot of breakdowns, because in the winter of 41-42, our brigade was north of Mosul, and there were 3 weeks then when the thermometer didn't get above freezing, and most of the time it was very much below freezing, and the supply trucks coming out from Mosul up to Bagush, I think our camp was called, where we were digging defences that looked over into Turkey roughly, the supply trucks firstly had great difficulties because the ground got frozen and rutted, and secondly they themselves broke down, and in the end, and it's described in this book, but I wasn't actually there, I was in hospital, the quads originally were towing the trucks through, Eventually they devised a system whereby the quads went through in convoy and then back again. But of course they were using their winches a good deal, because the quads were the only winch vehicles around there, or virtually the only ones. And as a result, our quads at the end of the winter of 41 were certainly in pretty... Well, they weren't in bad shape, but they'd been very hard used. And I'm not certain. I don't think we had replaced them by the time we did this journey. I would have to check the fact on that one. Don't forget, I'm the advance party. They came on behind me. But certainly just before this journey, our quads would have had a great deal of trouble keeping up with things. When we got to Cowley Camp Cowley, we changed quite a lot of things anyway, and I'm not certain what went in and what didn't. But I would be surprised if our quads faced that journey in good shape, and therefore I would expect some of them to have had... I'd expect the Remy truck to be arriving after I'd left for the next day's journey, in fact. But you, in a long convoy, you're never certain of what's happening behind you or in front of you.
What sort of daily routine did you have then as advance party? What time would you leave the overnight encampment in the morning?
I've really no idea, but it must have been sort of crack of dawn, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, up and quick burgoo and char breakfast and off and on. But I don't remember much of that journey at all, except that I was the advance party. And that there were these 1,000 women reputed to be in the desert ahead of me. But we never caught up with them.
Do you think that they exist, or they've just been...
I think they were probably to get us across the desert, I don't know. But they... But they interest me today, because I'm sure they were Palestinians. And I've often thought, you know, here were these 1,000 Palestinian women. I never asked them their religion or their nationality. They were Palestinians. It didn't interest me, and now, yet today, wars are being fought about this.
What was your job then as advance party? What were you supposed to be doing?
Very good question. Well, one has to have an advance party. I suppose when we got there, we must have marked out where people had to go, and we'd say, well, 8s and 4s over there, and the 3s and 5s over there, and RHQ over here, and there's the water tap, and we probably had... There must have been some sort of basic... there was perhaps one quartermaster at the place. I don't remember, but one did the type of things that one advance parties do.
What sort of vehicle did you have to travel in?
At that time, I was probably almost certainly in a Chef 1500 weight. Indeed, I've got a picture of myself a little later. A few days later, there is the vehicle.
And did that perform well in those conditions?
Yes, that was quite a good truck. Yes, I have quite. I don't remember any problems with the 1500 weight. But I'm not very good on things. I'm stronger on ideas and people.
Can you remember what you did overnight? Did you put tents up, or did you just kip in the back of the truck? Or
I should be pretty. So I don't suppose we put. In fact, we certainly don't think we put tents up. I should be most surprised if it. I can't remember. But, I mean, it was fairly common for us in those days. We all had our little bivouacs. And we had, as you say, the back of the truck. And underneath the truck and alongside the truck. And one didn't need 4-star accommodation in those days. And it didn't particularly worry one if one's bed was hard.
What about food? What sort of grub did you get?
We must have been able to refuel and pick up supplies on the way. I should be pretty certain that we probably picked up tins of soya links, similar looking tins of jam, hard tack, quite nice tins of bacon. Probably not condensed milk, but ideal milk type of stuff. I don't know. Well, perhaps Klim. Or its predecessor. Obviously, we didn't call Klim in those days. Perhaps dried eggs. But they typically. That's. You were asking me from the supply point of view, which I don't. I wasn't really concerned with in detail. I'm not good on things. But I can remember the type of meals we ate, certainly when we got into the desert, which was a 4-gallon tin of petrol cut in half. That was your saucepan. And in it... yes, well, 4-gallon petrol tins, they damn near lost the war for us, compared to the jerry can.
Why was that, too flimsy?
Flimsy... they wasted petrol all over the place. They weren't a practical container for petrol, but they were an excellent thing to make saucepans out of, make washing up dishes out of, make urinals out of, make stoves out of. And so one would chuck into one petrol can upside down, or half of one, some water, boil it up, probably make some tea, perhaps chuck in some biscuits, turn it out and stir in some jam. That's an excellent porridge. The bacon, which, I mean, that would be a normal meal quite often. The worst day I remember in the war was the one day that I didn't have one single cup of tea. And as you can see, tea isn't necessarily my favourite drink. But...
Many commentators have suggested that tea was absolutely vital to morale and efficiency.
Absolutely. The one day I remember in the war as being really bad was because it was actually Wadi Akarit, and we just got it brewed up. By then I lived in one of these lovely Tatanaga armoured cars, armoured AP vehicles, and we actually had a stop brewed up inside the car. We just got the water boiling. We were just about to check the tea and we moved off. And that day I didn't get one single cup. And I remember that as being a terrible day. Tea, char, certainly, of course it contained the sugar, but also had a social significance. I mean, Indian troops and British gunners could meet easily over a cup of char.
Whereas they couldn't eat over a meal, could they?
One usually did, but I mean, there were no taboos about char. Oh, no, we certainly met, in fact, one of my greatest friends, and this is after the desert period, this is Italy, was a chap called Buddha Singh Bhagwan. He was a major. He'd risen from sepoy to major in the war. He was one of the bravest men I ever knew. And in Greece, at the very end of the war, just after the fighting in Greece, he came into my tent late at night, and we'd been drinking together. Sikhs were allowed to drink. And he said, "I'm hungry, Jeff." And I said, "Well, all I've got boots is a tin of bully, and that's not jutka. Haven't been killed properly." And Boots said, "Give me the tin, Jeff." And he put the tin on the top of a wooden pole, and we all had kukris in those days, we'd inherited. He got out his kukri and he went, "Whoosh! Now it's jutka, Jeff." And we enjoyed it together. I told you the story earlier about the Satsiriya Karl and the food that we had with them and with the Gurks. I've often tried to find somewhere where they will serve a simple meal of curried aloos and dal, as the Gurks did it. I nearly managed it out at near the Gurks headquarters, not far from you, last year when I went to a charity thing and there was a Gurkha kitchen. It was almost there, but even they couldn't re-simplify it. Oh no, we would eat together and drink together and play together. By the time you shared slip trenches, we don't have many inhibitions about that sort of thing. Might be interesting the story of of one of my earlier colonels by the name of Francis Cleeve. He's a well-known gunner. He became a Brigadier Francis Cleeve, but in those days he was Colonel Cleeve, Squeaky Cleeve. He had a very squeaky voice. But he was the first TA colonel to take over my... first regular colonel to take over my TA regiment. He took us to France. And he used to scare the living daylights out of me until one day we were in camp together and we both had to squat over the same pole. And he suddenly realised... he's not just a squeaky colonel but also a man.
But are you saying then that religious taboos disappeared under the pressure of conditions in the desert?
No, not disappeared. They were, in my memory at least, certainly no barrier between European and Indian of any caste or creed or caste or creed or whatever it is. One respected the differences. I think one always accepted, certainly I did after the lessons I learned, that I haven't asked you whether you're Roman Catholic or Irish or Scots or Presbyterian or a Mason or... and you can see that my father was a Mason, probably, and you haven't said, well, the Methodist Church just chucked him out. It's not something that in one's normal daily round that worries one.
But in the case of India, for example, Indian troops and dealing with food, presumably, I mean, you wouldn't have been able to share a tin of bacon with a Punjabi.
One certainly couldn't share a tin of bacon with a Punjabi. But it requires a certain amount of visual acuity to pick out the meat in a stew. And not all people wish to be as keen-sighted as other people. But one certainly wouldn't offer that any more than I dream of offering a Jew ham. But I've known a fair number of Jews who ate steak and kidney pie that didn't necessarily come from a cow. I don't remember any. Sikhs, we always used to hope that the Sikhs were well worked, because they did tend to be political animals. But you knew the 5Ks. I can't remember what all the 5Ks are today. You knew they had the 5Ks. You respected them. You knew that Johnny Gurk had his little bit of hair to take him up to heaven, and thank God you respected him. The desert, in fact, was in many respects a very happy time. Italy was a different kettle of fish, and Crete was a very different kettle of fish. But in the desert was a bit like, I imagine tiger shooting must be. I don't know if I've ever shot any tigers. The Germans were one respected too. There were no houses to knock down, no women and children, and certainly for a gunner, gunnery is an intriguing occupation. Holding glasses to your eyes with flies coming off dead bodies is a different matter. But what you're looking at is really quite fun. And indeed, in 1985, it doesn't sound very civilised to say it, but I used to get as much fun out of trying to get to my OP and catch the German doing his little bit in the morning with his spade, and as he got out of trying to catch me getting out of my OP and doing my little bit with his spade. You know, it was like playing darts or... There were some very frightening moments, but there were very few horrifying moments, which there were in other sectors. Yeah.
You say you had respect to the Germans. What did you think of the Italians?
One used to talk of only eye ties, but by God, the Folgiore division, they're the ones who were on Himeimat, and they were standing throwing bombs and singing Aida. And there were some very brave Italians, and one or two of their units were extremely well organised and trained. I think it was the Folgore I'm thinking of, or the Ariete. And certainly later on, we're about a year from where we've been so far, their gunners were pretty good. Their equipment wasn't up to a 25-pounder, but some of their gunnery was quite good. So, yes, the Italians were a bit musical comedy, but at their best, they were very good indeed. Having given them a compliment, I'll now tell you a funny story about the Italians. Later on, at the end of North Africa, still in North Africa, when we got back to Alexandria, and peace had broken out, and everyone was training for Italy, and our RSM, Nobby Clark, was an enormous character. I'll tell you about him for hours. But our RSM had a squad of Italians making a real peacetime cantonment camp. And all the roads were neatly marked off in white stones, and the Italians loved this, and Nobby put up a flagpole with in front of it what he called a salaming stone, and the Italians loved that, and they ran the flag up and they cheered. And then the leader of the Italians came up to Nobby and saluted smartly and said, "Please, may we put stones round this POW Alamein Tunis 1942-1943 which shows that they're a great race. They were so badly led. Their hearts weren't in the war. Where their pride was concerned, they were very equally tough with the Germans. But they didn't believe in the war. They had no reason to believe in the war, except for those that came from North Africa themselves, who realised that their own existence was threatened. If you lived in Taranto, you didn't necessarily feel a great deal of sympathy with the claims of Iducci and Hitler.
It sounds like you found the Italians very, very mixed and unpredictable as an enemy. Were the Germans more consistent?
Oh, yes, I think so. Well, we've just been into Iraq. I said that our regiment went into Iran. I didn't go into Iran, but when our chaps were in Iran, they had to take a lot of fellow travellers prisoners, because Iran was thick with Germans and Italians. And it was very noticeable, and I wasn't there yet to see it, but it was. I can remember it all these years, because everyone reported on it, that the Italian suitcases were all full of pomades and lotions and beauty-making things, and the Germans were largely full of dirty books. Yeah, I hate to say it in a sense, because I've got some very good German friends, but that was an observation that was made of those two groups that were out there at that time. Well, the Italians, they are still a nation, I think, who sees service as ennobling rather than degrading. They love, they're terribly good at running restaurants and singing and making people happy. Whereas the Germans are still, in my experience, extremely good at making things run on time and clean. But less at making people happy. Oh, there are exceptions to all these rules, but I think that difference is not unreal.
Were there any formations amongst the Italians, other than those you mentioned, which always fought well, and were there others which always fought badly that you can recall?
I need notice of that question. I could. I think if we just switch off, we're probably going to be off another one.
I think you said that there were some Italians at one point who were singing Aida as they were under attack.
Yes, I didn't hear them, but it was general. It was one of the myths of the desert, and I don't know whether it was the Folgore or the Areti, or there's one other, the Bersaglieri. But I mean, one didn't mix with these people socially. One minute threw things at one another. So I think at that time one was always happier to think that there was an Italian the other side than the 15th Panzer or the 90th Light, because it probably meant that Rommel was less interested in you than it was a sign of his intentions as much as one's own value judgment. While you're sorting that question out, my wife,
what was your first impression of Egypt when you drove into it from Palestine?
We drove through the canal zone, which of course was fairly much a land of milk and honey, but we didn't stop anywhere. We merely there was water and decent buildings, which we hadn't seen for some time. I don't know that we stayed anywhere at that time long enough to have an impression of Egypt. And we went through in 2 days, which was spent in drawing rations.
Didn't you stop in Cairo?
We stopped at County Camp.